August 10th, 1993, until her death just over a year ago on September 18th, 2020. And she was known for some extremely liberal views, but that were borne out in what she called baby steps or slow, measured progress. Her death left a vacancy, which had to be filled. Do y'all remember this? Oh, you do? Okay. You remember this in the news cycle. It was all over the news because the then president, Donald Trump, vowed to fill this seat, and he nominated, who we have here, Amy Coney Barrett. There was a big concern with this nomination, a lot of concern. Here's some of the headlines. Amy Coney Barrett, a dream for the right, nightmare for the left. Amy Coney Barrett, the Supreme Court nominee on abortion, on health care, and on faith. What did she believe in those areas? Amy Coney Barrett, what it could mean for Obamacare. The views of the Supreme Court nominee, Amy Coney Barrett. And this last one, Amy Coney Barrett, the cruel irony of a female originalist. What's that mean? An originalist. Yeah. So this, what I'm about to read for you, comes from this article. It says, Barrett subscribes to a judicial philosophy known as originalism, in which judges pledge to interpret the Constitution as understood by the framers and the public at the time that it was written. Barrett also describes herself as a textualist, meaning that she interprets the law strictly according to its text without considering the larger goals of the legislators who wrote it. How dare she? Right? How dare she read the Constitution according to how it was intended to be interpreted? So the problem with Amy isn't that she was a Catholic. It's not that she was actually pro-life. It's not that she held conservative political views or views about policy. The problem is that she was an originalist and a textualist. I think all of us are probably generally familiar with the terms like left and right when we talk about policy, or sometimes we use the words conservative or liberal. You know where the terminology left and right comes from? It's where they sit in it's where they sit in the chambers, right? The left sits on the left and the right sits on the right. Yeah, it's very mundane that way. Yeah. And so we could probably come up with some of the views of, you know, the differences between left policy and right policy. You know, right policy is for lower taxes generally, left policy for maybe higher taxes. Right is for, well, we don't want the government to provide a safety net. We want other institutions to do that. Not that there couldn't be a safety net, but we don't think it's the government's job. Maybe the left is the opposite of that. And we're not here to necessarily declare either one of those right or wrong, but just to say that there is a spectrum of political views. But when we talk about a conservative justice, a justice who's conservative, we're not talking about that same spectrum. If I were a math teacher, I am a math teacher, I would put a line perpendicular to that line, and I would say when we're talking about a justice being either conservative or liberal, we're really talking about that question of originalism. If they are a conservative judge, they can have policy views over here on the left, or they could have policy views over here on the right. But a conservative judge is going to read what was originally written and be bound by that. And a liberal judge could have policy views on the right or could have policy views on the left. And whatever those views are going to help them in making policy from the bench. So, what are we talking about here? We're talking about the Constitution, right? Judicial philosophy is not about one's personal views, but about how you read and interpret that document. This is former judge, Justice Antonin Scalia. And I got to see an interview with Antonin Scalia, and they were asking him questions about a recent opinion that he gave. And I was pretty amazed at the depth of what he was talking about, because they were pointing at some Constitution stuff, and he pointed to the Constitution. He pointed to the words that are there. But then he started speaking about the Federalist Papers. Have you all read the Federalist Papers? All the papers that were written during the time of the Articles of Confederacy, before we actually ratified the Constitution. And then he talked about how the Magna Carta played into some of the writers of the Constitution's decisions. And he went on to even talk about English common law and Blackstone's commentary on that. And he's taken all of this history and all of the stuff around it to understand what does the text of the Constitution actually mean. He understands that we are 200 years separated, more now, from the writing of this document, that our language has shifted, and that he needs to read the Constitution in the context of the original drafters as much as possible in order to understand what that text actually means. What's the other view? So if it's not originalism, it's, do you know? The living document view. That sounds so good. I believe the Constitution is a living document, right? It sounds good, but what does it actually mean? Well, it means that I can look at the 14th... It should be, let's just go back here. I can look at the 14th Amendment, which was an amendment that guaranteed citizenship for everyone, regardless of your race, and I can find in that 14th Amendment the right to have an abortion. That's what a living view of the Constitution means. I can find that it is wrong in that 14th Amendment for colleges to be all male. Now, maybe you do agree that colleges shouldn't be all male. Maybe every college should, if it's state-funded, should have to accept both male and female. But we don't find that in the 14th Amendment. Maybe you believe, if you follow this doctrine, you could find the fact that schools shouldn't be segregated in the 14th Amendment. Now, again, you may agree that schools should not be segregated based on race. The question is it found in the 14th Amendment? Because though that is the amendment that was cited to provide those rulings. Maybe you recall from your civics class that policy is made by the legislative branch, Congress. And that policy is enforced by the executive branch, and policy is only interpreted by the judicial branch, which is what we're talking about. Now, in the wisdom that our founding fathers had, they provided a mechanism to amend our Constitution. In fact, the first 10 amendments they felt were so important to guarantee individual rights and state rights, that came along with the ratification of the Constitution. But that process, it's hard to do. If I remember right, it's 3/4 of the Congress and 3/4 of the states have to agree to the amendment. But under the living document philosophy of interpreting the Constitution, I only need 5 justices to agree that now the Constitution says something that really it never, ever said. and we can find new rights there. Justice Clarence Thomas said this, "Let me put it this way. There are really only two ways to interpret the Constitution. Try to discern as best as we can what the framers intended, or make it up. No matter how ingenious, imaginative, or artfully put, unless interpretive methodologies are tied to the original intent of the framers, they have no more basis in the Constitution than the latest football scores. To be sure, even the most conscientious effort to adhere to the original intent of the framers of our Constitution is flawed, and all methodologies and human institutions are, but at least originalism has the advantage of being legitimate, and I might add, impartial." So the concern is, no matter whether you find yourself politically on the left or politically on the right, is if you have a bunch of justices just making up the law and reading into the Constitution what they want, then there is no standard of law anymore. Confucius, a long time ago, I don't think he said it in English, but he said this phrase, which we translate into English, "When words lose their meaning, people lose their lives." And that has been heralded over and over as we find different laws being changed, different meanings of words being changed to fit the agenda of today. This is important. I hope you feel the weight of it. I think probably most of us feel the weight of the Constitution and it's being interpreted correctly. This is the highest law in our land. Every other law is to be subject to this law. So whether you're on the left or whether you're on the right, we should all want conservative judges, right? And we go through that process. This is the highest law, right? And we need to find what the original framers' intent was. Yep. We cannot go to this and find our own meaning. Agree? We cannot just say, I think this means this to me. I need to do some hard work. Just like Justice Antonin Scalia had to learn all that stuff about the Magna Carta, about the Federalist Papers, had to do all this research just to know how to interpret, I think he was talking about the Second Amendment then, that's probably why I was watching it. We, when we're reading, there's a lot of background information that we need. This is separated by us by 200 years, and it's written in English. From our culture. This is separated from us, in some cases, maybe 4,000 years. Job, the first book written, probably around 4,000 years ago. Moses, when he wrote the Pentateuch, around 3,500 years ago. Psalms, the psalm that we just read today, written about 3,000 years ago. Romans, 1,966 years ago, give or take. Our most recent book, Revelation, 1,931 years ago. So this book is from a different time. You got that? It's from a different culture. This book talks about ancient Jews, scattered Jews after the deportation and after Assyria takes over the northern tribes. Talks about Greek culture, Roman culture, Babylonian culture, Persian culture. This book is from different cultures. It's written in ancient Hebrew, a little bit of Aramaic, and Greek. It's written in a different language. It can be difficult to read this book with original intent, especially if I gave you the Greek and Hebrew manuscripts, right? Curtis talked a little bit last week about translations, and we will spend some time talking about translations in this class. A lot of the work that I've been describing has been done for us, thankfully, by good men and women who have studied hard and done some of that research and tried to faithfully produce into English what was written here so that we can read it and understand it. It's a lot of hard work, but it's important. It's important that we read this and we try to extract what was originally said. I've watched a sermon online that probably had the most verse references I've ever seen in a sermon, but they were all three or four words here, three or four words here, three or four words of a verse here, three or four. And then the pastor's own meeting was just put on top of those words. And that pastor, what he was saying wasn't wrong, but the verses that he was using to support what he was saying did not actually support what he was saying in context. We call that right sermon, wrong verse. And hopefully, I appreciate Joel and Curtis and Tim and Danny, and I try to do the same. When we open up a passage, we're trying to give you that background information. We're going verse by verse, and we're showing how that meaning is found in what was written today. I think even Joel said that today. These aren't Joel's thoughts. This was written by David. These are David's thoughts, and I'm just explaining it to you. Okay, let's take a left turn here. We're going to talk more, but I do want to talk about this. That's okay. Around 20 years ago, I was given this book for Christmas. This is a collector's edition of The Hobbit. This is leather bound. Really liked it. This was back when I was in the Navy and making ensign pay, and money was hard to come by. And I found this book, its companion, in the bookstore and didn't buy it. And I saw these, and every now and then I would look online to see if I could find this book, and it would be a little more scarce, a little bit more expensive, a little bit more scarce, a little bit more expensive. And finally, this spring, I bit the bullet, and I was like, I better buy it now, or it's going to become more and more rare. So this is The Lord of the Rings. It's a leather-bound book, and I really enjoy Lord of the Rings. You may know that if you've been around me. And shamefully, there was a time in my life when I had read that book through cover to cover more than any other book. More than any other book. Check. I can say that that's not the case today. But I love the story, and I have encouraged my kids to read it and enjoy it and find the truths from it. We started listening to the audio version of The Hobbit on our way to school, and once that was done, we just rolled right into The Fellowship of the Ring, and we're listening to it, and man, I'm loving it. And I remember there was a time when we were at the Council of Elrond. Hopefully you know this, but if you don't, you'll just have to get my enthusiasm from it. And they're at the part where they're asking, who is going to take the ring? Who's going to take the ring? And finally, Frodo says, I'll take it, but I don't know the way. And as I'm tearing up now, I'm driving to school tearing up. And I'm like, Frodo doesn't know what he's getting into. He's about to have this horrible time. And then my thought goes to Paul and Ananias when God says, I'm going to show him how much he has to suffer. And I think about how those hobbits are transformed from the beginning to the end. You know, if you've read the books, not necessarily the movies, you know that they come back and the Shire is out of order. And those old hobbits, they would have just, not these transformed hobbits. They take charge, and they say, not in my Shire, right? And I'm thinking about all this and how God uses hard times in our lives to transform us. I'm just, and Chloe's like, wait. Who is Aragorn again? And who is this Boromir guy? And I'm like, we just went over this. Aragorn is Strider. And Strider was the guy in the inn, right? Yes. I want you to be able to cry when Frodo says, I'll take the ring, but I don't know the way. And the only way that you're going to be able to put that much in and get that much out really is if you read this book. And I have read this book slow. And if you've read the book, you know there are lots of poetry in there about Isildur and Lothuvian and all these, and I probably can't even name them right now. And who's the guy and the girl who fall in love? Yes, thank you. And sometimes those poems can be difficult to understand. And sometimes I've read it fast. I'm like, you know what? I'm skipping the poetry, and I'm just going to go through because this is just a feel-good. I just want to read it. I want to remind myself. I've watched movies made about this book. And, you know, we've all argued about how good are those movies compared to the book. Should they have left Tom Bombadil out, or should they have put him in? Those are big questions when it comes to Lord of the Rings, right? I've listened to podcasts on Lord of the Rings, watched videos on Lord of the Rings. And so I can just jump anywhere into this book, know what's going on, and feel what the characters are feeling, and know the emotions and be moved by that book. Yeah. If we're going to be able to jump anywhere into this book and know what's going on and be able to see what God's plan is at that moment and to be able to understand what's God's purpose in lowering Jeremiah into a pit when he's prophesying and be able to look at that and go, you know what? I hope God's in charge of America just like he was in Israel, and I know that's the case. Because Jeremiah went through some tough, tough times while God was teaching Israel a lesson. And America could be going through some tough, tough times while God teaches us a lesson. In fact, Jeremiah wrote a whole book about his sadness over that called Lamentations. And the only way that you're going to be able to dive in and be able to open up and know what's going on and understand the context and not be asking, now, who is Mephibosheth? And what is Lodabar? Is this you actually spend the time and read this book? There's been debates, and I listen to them or read them, about should you read the Bible fast or slow? What do you think? Both. Both. Because if you don't have the big picture of what's going on, it's going to be tough. But sometimes we need to slow down. Sometimes we need to pick this word apart and go verse by verse and understand the logical argument that Paul is giving us. Have we ever watched a movie about the Bible? Maybe y'all watched The Chosen and you've said, just like the movies The Lord of the Rings, how close is it? Are they taking too much license with it, or is it okay? Does this give us further insight? Maybe you've listened to some podcasts about the Bible, right? All of those ways that I was investing in this book, and this has got, this is written by a Christian. It's got a lot of good Christian themes in it. If there's a non-Bible book that's not about the Bible, this is probably my highest recommendation for you. But this has got to be where it's at, right? Right? We've got to read this and understand it. In the fall, in the spring, we're going to be doing a study by J. Warner Wallace. But one time at a conference, he talked about how he gets a case. Now, if you're not familiar with J. Warner Wallace, he's a cold case detective. He's been trained in testimony and eyewitness accounts. In fact, he was an atheist, and his training in testimony led him, when he read the Gospels, go, that has all the hallmarks of true eyewitness testimony, just like I've been trained to detect in police work. And that was one of the things that really convinced him that the Bible was true. But he talked about getting a case. And if you've ever seen a cold case, there's like this shelf, and there's this box with all this stuff in it. And he's got to pull this box out, and there's all these notes, and the notes are not in order. The notes are taken by different people. The notes have different significance. And he says, I just sit down and I start reading the notes, and they don't make any sense at first. And I read it and I go, okay, let's start a pile. This one goes here. I read it. This one must come first before that. And he reads the notes and he reads the notes and he puts them in chronological order as he's working through all of these evidences and statements that were given by eyewitnesses, and that there was a trial, all of the testimony, and he's putting them in order. He says, once I go through all of that, putting it in order, you know what I have to do again? Read it again. And then I read it again. And then I read it again. And then I read it again until I know every piece of information in that cold case. I know it better than the defense. I know it better than anyone because I put it in order and I've read it over and over and over again. Put it in order and read it over and over and over and over and over again. Currently, I listen to the Bible every morning on the way in. It's like my flyby. So, you know, we're talking about different speeds that we read on. And that's what I do. I would recommend to you, highly recommend, that the biggest thing that you can do if you want to understand this book is to read it over and over and over again. And you know, it's not always in chronological order. Okay? So you can find podcasts that will put it in chronological order for you, or not podcasts, but programs, Bible apps, that will put it in chronological order for you. And there's different ways of doing that. Some may be better than others, but just read it. Read it in different translations if you'd like, but read it over and over and over again. Lord of the Rings is a complicated book that spans several cultures, follows many characters, and has a deep history associated with it. You're not going to understand it like you should by picking it up and reading it a little bit here and there. And the same can be said of the Word of God. It's a complicated book. It spans lots of different cultures, lots of different years, but we need to read it and understand it. Okay? Let's pray. Dear Father, we just thank you for your word. I pray that as we go through this series, and we look at tools to understand your word, that you will open up our eyes, you will open up our hearts to the meaning that you put into the word. And then as we extract that, we will be able to apply it faithfully to our lives. I pray that we will be people of your word, and that we will read it fast, we will read it slow, we will be listening to it, as Moses said, in our homes, when we're away from our home, in the morning, in the evening, at work and at play, that your word would just surround us in all that we do. and that we would become familiar with it, and that we would be able to fly into a spot and understand what's going on and understand how you're moving in there, and then be able to take heart knowing that you are at work even in our lives today. Just pray for our church and this time together, and that you will bless our efforts as we study your Bible.